cited a classic Zen poem called The Song of the Precious Mirror Samadhi. And one of my favorite couplets reads, "When inverted thinking stops, the affirming mind naturally accords." Well, inverted thinking is all of our upside-down thinking, all of our deluded thinking, all of our mishigas, all of our ideas about things that aren't really not quite how things are, all our inverted or upside-down thinking. So it says, when this kind of thinking subsides, stops, the affirming mind naturally accords. So that's a promise, in a sense, a hypothesis for us to test, because we're not doing blind faith here, but we want to have a little encouragement here, that when that stew and storm and complexity of ideas settles down, that what is there is not just nothing, but an affirming mind that naturally accords with reality, that naturally fits. Whether we know it or not, whether it feels like it or not, but that is there, that we're not responsible then for constructing something. We're trying to drop something. When we drop away the messy robes of our complicated ideas, when we have our shirts on backwards and our pants on our heads, we take all that off, there's a natural person and a natural universe there, naturally according. At the same time, we are active beings. And so what I want to look at is the care and feeding of awareness. Because this natural mind, or this mind that naturally accords, or the person who naturally accords, is a person with in awareness, some kind of awareness. Less clouded. What we're saying is all the clothes of our thoughts and ideas and opinions clothe our actually direct and also obscure our awareness. We think they are our awareness, but our awareness is living in it, and we take, as we let go of those, as we drop those off, and we arrive momentarily perhaps at this moment and leave again and return again, we're not entering some vague grayness. We're coming to where our awareness can come forth in a more expanded way, not in the same little, just in the little channels and runnels it's used to. So here's awareness. That's what's there. The complicated thoughts drop away. Your awareness is there. You're there, whatever you are. So let's look at just in terms of your awareness. But what is it? It's a nice word. What are we? What we're aware of? Are we what we take in and digest? That's what awareness is doing. You know, we are what we eat with all our senses. Is that what we are? Is that what's happening in awareness? Awareness is never static, and that's why the care and feeding of awareness is very relevant, without it being a program or a graduated set of exercises, because this is not a self-help movement or a going to school and getting accomplishments and goals. And yet there is very much nurturing and expanding our awareness, not only by dropping off the complicated thoughts. For one thing, we're always taking in so much more than we know, so much more than we credit. We receive today's living body, the sun, no fog this morning, breakfast, our ability to eat it, beautiful silence, words that do their best to be meaningful and even graceful. We take in bird sounds and car sounds. We have ears to hear them with. We have 6 senses of awareness. Buddhism says that the old Buddhist description is not the 5 senses of the West, but 6 senses. All are the senses of awareness for taking in the world, always receiving life, constantly. It never stops. So the 6 senses traditionally described are the 5 ones that we know as the ordinary sensory awarenesses of eye, ear, nose, smell, the mouth, tasting, and feel, and consciousness. Conscious awareness, described as a 6th kind of sensory awareness. Now, a lot of what we would see the 6th sense doing is a triage, sorting and triage. What are we going to pay attention to? How are we going to organize the information from the other senses? How are we going to weave it into something that we can call meaning or call coherence? And we don't even realize how much weaving is going on until we read Oliver Sacks about the man who mistook his wife for a hat. The basics of organizing our perceptions that we take so much for granted and are so precious. Our mind turns to prior experience to do something with all this welter coming in. There's a huge, huge amount of perception coming in at all times. And coming up from inside. Coming up into our sensory awareness. And so the mind turns to prior experience for patterns, for filters, for organizing. Well, we've got to do it on something. And that's everything we have been. Is now here as us doing this filtering and organizing and weaving together in this moment and then creating the self of the next moment. So of course we do have a self, powerfully, but it's forever shifting and changing based on what has come to be and what's coming in and coming up now. We turn to our conscious and our unconscious values. Feelings, views, opinions, history, all of that. And then the mind looks outward for new opinions and new possibilities, new ways to organize this welter that's going on. Oh, is that music? Okay, I'll try to see it as music. There was a performance in the New York Philharmonic last week in which the composer took mostly the percussion section, but some others, to a junkyard. Because it's got to be local. He's done this performance before, but you have to use local junk. So they went to a New York junkyard, and they tried out various kinds of junk until they found things that had really interesting sounds, and they took them into, I guess it's Avery Fisher Hall, and they used them in a concert, along with a little bit of I think, of woodwinds, perhaps. But it was primarily good local junk. New possibilities based on an existing idea that he's done before, and yet it's new. John Cage's great piece of music called 4:33, 4 minutes and 33 seconds, still shocks people because nothing happens. People walked out, people got screened the first time it was performed, people still makes people very uncomfortable. The piece called 4 minutes 33 seconds involves nothing, no musical sounds happening whatsoever. It was very disturbing. Remains disturbing to people. But it's always new. If any time it's performed, it's going to be new. We do it all the time. We're really good at that one. Right here. But that's because we're not expecting something else to happen. The time when we're sitting in a concert hall expecting to be, you know, uplifted and entertained and moved by these sounds and they don't happen, we're going to be just as fussed as the next person. So there's this mind of possibility and this mind of expectation. The same silence in a different context is a very different thing. And this, so the mind, which is doing this awareness processing, has to weigh and evaluate and judge endlessly. Endless judgments about what is good to eat, what to take in, what's worthwhile right now. And on what basis do we evaluate? We hardly know. We can hardly even articulate really the reasons for our conscious values, let alone the sort of unconscious ones. So on what basis do you evaluate or judge what's happening, how you organize this moment's perceptions into something you call awareness? And how much do you track what your mind is doing? There are many people who don't do Zazen especially, don't even understand that as a statement, tracking what your mind is doing. Because until you do a practice, whether it's Zazen or another one of this sort, you simply have a mind doing it. And you know you have a mind doing it, and you can be present in your mind doing it, but you're not actually aware of it as a mind that's doing one thing and not doing another thing so much. So we have this mind of awareness working at sort of super speed, and it gets tired and stale. And then when the mind gets tired and stale, it seems as though the world is tired and stale. There's little enlivening. This is boring. You know, there's no flavor here. What do you do when your mind gets stale and doesn't have an appetite for life? Or doesn't see what is offered as good food? You know, our minds narrow into channels and it narrows into ruts. But when the mind is inside that little canal, that little channel, it doesn't see that happening. It's just occupying that channel. And we're fooled into thinking that life is a rut. I've told some of you that I lived in the woods in Massachusetts for some years. For about 7 years, I built a little cabin. And then I lived in it while I built a house 100 feet away. And the house took 4 or 5 years. And then once the house was built, the cabin became my studio. And I loved that cabin. And then I moved away to Minnesota to train and to ordain and went back a year later to organize to sell the house. And there was a little tiny place between the two buildings where nothing could grow. I had trodden it so hard. A narrow little rutted path that I hadn't noticed I was creating. I was just doing my life, coming and going, but it was always taking place in this one narrow little track, so pressed down that nothing could grow there. I thought, oh my God, that's what a rut is. And I was in one. You know, it was my own rut. I created it all by myself out of a nice open piece of woodland. There wasn't a path there before I made that rut. My dog helped. It wasn't Pansy, it was Jojo, the first bulldog, would follow me back and forth. But I'm bigger and heavier, and I have bigger feet. I did most of the rut making. She was just following along. It was very, very startling to see the rut I had created in my life. And there had been a sense of staleness eventually, you know, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, not really noticing. You know, there were 12 acres. What was I doing? I was going back and forth and back and forth. Sometimes I would say, oh, there's the woods. I will now take time off and go do something. The rest of the time it was back and forth and back and forth. The mind does this. The life does this. It's terrible. Luckily, sometimes we get to see it, painful as it is. The only thing worse than seeing that rut is not seeing it. When we create a rut and we travel along in it, and sometimes there's a sense of, there's a kind of a comfort in it. You know, I know where to put my foot next, right there, keep going. The world begins to feel like a sluggish wash because our life has slowed down. The juice of our life has slowed down into this narrow little canal. Other times, our minds create defensive walls like the Great Wall of China, and then there we are behind that wall, and that's just how it is. Very hard to see those. We think that's my life, or that's the world, that's how I am, or that's all I am. When what we have is a wall that we've created in the midst of our life. So we want an awareness that we know how do we get our mind out of that, from behind the wall, or out of that rut, out of that little channel. Poor thing, stuck. so many ways we take in life. We receive and we receive and we receive, and when we aren't narrowing it down, there's a tremendous amount coming in. And that's only one side of what we are being and can have awareness of. The other side of receiving is giving, is producing, is the moving out, is the outward flow of energy. We're not only endlessly receiving inputs and evaluating and digesting them. We're always sending out at all times. We ourselves are as much shaped by what we give out as by what we take in. It's a little harder to see that because we know ourselves taking in food and eating and digesting food of all kinds. Food of heart, mind, and spirit. Good food, bad food, other people's opinions, our own indigestions. We know taking in that we are forever giving out. Can't do one without, there wouldn't be room for more to come in if things didn't go out. But we are shaped by what we send out, by what we give out, by what we say, by what we do, by how we respond. That is as much who we are as what we are from receiving and digesting. So what do we and how do we give and extend? With what direction and with what passion? And how does that emerge from your awareness of yourself? What are the ways in the care and feeding of awareness? The ways that, how do you remember that you are bigger and deeper and wider than however you currently think at this moment? Want to enjoy, accept, maybe not always enjoy, accept the awareness and thought and feeling of this moment. And whatever it is, big or little, it is not all of who we are. We tend to cling to it. There's always room to move out into something bigger, deeper, and wider. That is ourself in relationship, always receiving and giving. How I see you is shaped by the current of my thought, my Great Wall of China of the day, my little rut of the morning. Now, if I'm operating just as a scanty stream, you're going to look like a dusty trickle. There's just not going to be much to exchange. And the little less I can see you, the less I can receive. And if I'm operating a counting house, I'm going to see you as a thief. No one benefits from that. Well, those are the kinds, those minds that we have that we get stuck in, impede the receiving of nourishment, the giving of nourishment, the flow and the passion and the awareness of life. So how do you take care of your awareness? What are the ways to cultivate and refine it? What keeps you fresh and open? What returns you to being fresh and open, receptive, able to move and create? How do you nourish passion in your life and caring and attention? If we nourish attention, caring, and passion in our life, we have a very lively awareness, but how do we do that? How do you decide what to say yes to and what to say no to? Sometimes we see our judgmental minds and are so appalled that we kind of want to swear off all judgment, but we can't take a step without evaluating this and not that. What do you do to remember that your life is made of your ability to love and to be wise? And to receive love and wisdom. How do I figure out what to say week after week? Beats me. I started in one place yesterday and wound up in a completely different. I'll come back to that. I started with an Emily Dickinson poem. And I couldn't go forward with it, but I realized that the reason I started with her poem was that for me, she's a primary person, voice, and poet of subjective awareness. Every poem is about awareness of life. On one page, it was about the something falling down to the stones of her mind. The next page, we had death. You know, and it's always a subjective awareness presence of seeing. It's always awareness, seeing. And so I left off the poem and went on with awareness. Whatever I say has to come out of my own experience. And yet, it can't be just my personal experience, because, you know, that's not big enough. That doesn't extend enough. That's an old story. How does it not just be an old story? What do we, how do we take our personal experience, which is the stuff we work with, and not just as an old story? It's lovely to have some of the old stories. That rut is still with me. It's become a story, but that's one way I don't forget it. I can still see it in the woods. The cabin got torn down after I moved away. But the cabin and the house and the rut and the woods around them are still there in my mind. How do we be aware and see life and what is here before us as relevant to ourselves, and how do we be relevant to life? How do we connect and engage? What's good food? I thought, well, so maybe I could just stop here with all these great questions. No, huh?
That was a great
response. That was a wonderful response. But aren't these the question? What's better than a good question? Good questions, good food themselves. They are food for thought, right? Yeah. So, what do I do, and how do you move from questions, not exactly to answers? I mean, answers are nice, but they're all kind of today's answers. They're like beautiful flowers on the altar on a table, and they're lovely today, and then they wilt. And then you compost them, and then they go on from there. A question will last a lot longer than any one answer. An answer is fresh and relevant for a little while, and then life changes. And that answer is no longer, doesn't quite hit it anymore. I've always loved questions. What I move to from questions is to investigations, not to answers. Won't get it. Don't have much for answers. I got lots of investigations though. Because the investigating, the getting curious, is what opens a kind of the doors of awareness. And my answer is barely good enough for me right now, let alone I'm not going to, you know, really do Liz's life. So I looked. So I stopped and said, okay, what do I see if I look? Oh, my God. One of the reasons I was churning in 10 directions over a talk yesterday, because my life is like a three-ring circus. There's the Zendo. This is a big ring in my circus. And then there's my new partnered life. That's a big ring in my circus. And then there's my new home and this fence building this weekend and the landscaping, the bamboo and the furniture that just arrived from Massachusetts. And I said, oh, my God, no, that's only three of the rings. There's the four-ring circus. There's the whole political and social world and voting right now, which reminds me, you know. But there's a big political social world happening all around us, with us, in us. No, it's a five-ring circus. There's the natural world and all the harm being done to it and what we might do to redress that. There's at least a five, and I quit it. I can't count. Couldn't count more than five rings. I saw a very small circus once, one of those little traveling ones. I don't know if there's still any around in this country. Are there still?
Yeah.
It came to the Cape Cod, and they had camped out in a field near Hyannis, and they had three elephants, two or three elephants, that were out there in the back peering at some scrub pines and wondering if they were good to eat. And they set up by hand, they hammered down the pegs for the little tent, and then the big tent, they had a little machine, and then they hitched an elephant up to a harness, and it raised the poles on the tent. And they had three rings, but they didn't have that many people, so they did something in one ring at a time. And I thought, well, okay, that's pretty nice. You can pay attention to everything that's happening. And then some of the same people, of course, the owner who I'd seen sitting and sewing his tent, we went early, sewing on the tent, later took tickets and then later threw knives at his wife. Because I got to talking to people who knew, in fact, it was the husband. Yeah. And they both, the marriage, and they survived the event that day. So everything was moving around, and yet there was only one thing at a time happening. But my life doesn't feel like that. It feels much more like a five-ring circus. And then I turned to zazen and silence and incense. These days I'm perfuming my zazen at home as much as here with incense. And I turned to friends and lover for true ways to feel and enjoy, because I'm going like this. And I need someone else to sort of catch me, just even by showing up in front of me. That's the beauty of this relationship I am. We just show up in front of each other and we are come back to an awareness that then has room to not just be flailing or caught in some five-ring circus rut, but to have feeling and enjoyment. And I turn to the ocean and the sun shining through the leaves. Since the ocean is all of half an hour away, I don't get there as often as I'd like, so I look up at the leaves in the trees and in the bamboo. I turn to beauty. It doesn't have to be fancy. A friend gave me on Friday, when I went to visit, a twig that he found that had just fallen out of the tree on Adam, and it was a particularly beautiful little twig, and he gave it to me. I think I still have it, but anyway, it was beautiful at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I still remember what it looked like. It's not fancy. Beauty isn't fancy. Beauty is what reminds us that we're alive and aware and giving and taking at all times. I turn to poetry, right, for those honed true words. And to good books, always. And friends for insight. I need new ideas. You know, I already know what I think, sort of. But however much I know what I already think, I know there's a lot more that I don't know. And I would like to be able to open my ears enough to hear more. Sometimes the mind leads, sometimes the body leads. But the mind in all this, the mind of awareness, needs space to experience itself. It needs space to open wider to experience the world of this moment, which is not just around us, but is us. And the mind of awareness needs the space to appreciate what is found there. That pell-mell approach at super speed doesn't leave time, space to note, taste, and appreciate. The mind of awareness needs to know its deep purpose. It needs to know there is a mind of awareness. Needs to know its deep purpose of finding and shaping continuity and coherence. It's a grand thing that the mind of awareness is doing. Our sense of coherence and continuity in life, which tends to be shaky, and at the same time, to the extent that we have such a sense, it's beautiful or awful, but it is rich and deep. The mind of awareness needs to know its deep purpose of finding and shaping continuity. And we call that shape, beauty, truth, wisdom. The mind of awareness needs to cultivate discernment. What the mind turns to, how it thinks and feels, how it values thinking, feeling, experience. We develop this. It's not, there's not a program for it, but we develop this. And how do we develop it? Always the question is better, how? We develop with attention. For me, I say it with attention, with care, and with passion. The The mind of awareness needs playfulness. It needs lightness. And otherwise it thinks it's heavy and solid and dense. The mind of awareness needs to meet darkness. It needs to meet the darkness that we can learn to be comfortable with, and it needs to meet the darkness that's beyond that. Otherwise, the mind of awareness skitters around in fear. The mind of awareness has to be willing to go beyond itself. You see, what this comes down to is that the mind of awareness is creative, always. We forget that. Our awareness is creative. That's its nature. It's always seeing new, it's always seeing fresh, always making fresh associations, always in this new moment. And I think that's why Zazen has never gotten boring for me in all these years, because it is a way of being aware and of returning to an awareness where things aren't how I expect them to be. And when they are, I can see that. I'm caught in a little rut, in a channel, in a recycled thought. But I know that's a recycled thought. That isn't my whole awareness. Awareness is always creative. And so, and then everything that is creative feeds awareness. Whatever happens, new and fresh and alive and changing, feeds awareness. Our awareness feeds on the new, the change, the different color from what it has seen before, the contrast between two things, the new perception. That's a natural tendency of the mind to see what is different and new and in contrast, what moves. That's what is the simplest form of what is new and fresh and creative in our environment, in our world, that we take in and are renewed by and have a renewed awareness of. Freshness coming in, freshness going out. So Zazen is a creative act every time. I thought of Henry Ford's dictum that creativity is 5% inspiration and 95% perspiration. And Zazen is in a way like that, in a way not like that. The way it's like that is you got to keep doing it. Sit down anyway. And sometimes Zazen just does kind of feel like that perspiration. You just do it and you feel dull, tastes kind of like sawdust. In that sense, the doing it is just keeping on doing it. But it's always not only that. We're not just doing perspiration. We're not practicing for some other time. We're always sitting down in the middle of our life. There's always the creative act. Zen has been described as, in one of the classic phrases for it, as a wholehearted investigation of the way. But to practice Zen in this way is to let Zen point beyond Zen, point beyond itself, beyond what anything we might think of as Zen, or our Zen practice, or Buddhism. It's to live as fully and generously and passionately as we can. Today, tomorrow, right here, taking in as widely and seeing that this is all a grand life experience, expression of awareness of giving and receiving, that the awareness, which awareness then extends the giving and receiving. In a way, we practice Zen to not practice Zen. But it is. Does help us with the care and feeding of awareness. Is that a little better? That's the end of what I have to say. I have reached the end of where I've gotten to.